Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ian Shin. Today, our guest is Tamara Vannett Shelton, who's going to talk about her new book, Herbs and Roots, A History of Chinese Doctors in the American Medical Marketplace, published in 2019 by Yale University Press. Tamara Vannett Shelton is Associate Professor of History at Claremont McKenna College, where her research focuses on the social history of the American West, with particular focus on race, labor, and the environment. She's also the author of A Squatter's Republic, Land and the Politics of Monopoly in California, 1850 to 1900. Herbs and Roots is about the long 200-year history of Chinese medicine in the United States. And in our conversation, we talk about the surprising and resilient decisions that Chinese herbalists and Chinese doctors make as they interface with both Chinese and non-Chinese patients from the colonial period up to the present. I hope that you enjoy our conversation. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Asian American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ian Shin, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we have the pleasure of talking to Tamara Vannett Shelton about her book, Herbs and Roots, A History of Chinese Doctors in the American Medical Marketplace, published by Yale University Press in 2019. Tamara, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. I wonder if we can start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself. And your background?
Sure. Well, I am a fourth generation Californian. I have lived in California nearly all my life. I currently live in Claremont, California, which is about 30 miles east of Los Angeles. But I grew up in Pasadena. My mother was born and raised in Chinatown, in San Francisco Chinatown. My dad met her in Berkeley in the 60s. So we are, you know, we've got these sort of deep roots in California. I'm a proud Californian, but I did go temporarily to the East Coast and did my undergraduate degree at Amherst, where I majored in history, a college that you might be familiar with, Ian. And then I did my PhD, came back to California, did my PhD at Stanford, and specialized in the history of the American West. So much of my research for the first part of my career was really focused on social and political movements in the 19th century American West, especially those that sprang up in California in the wake of the acquisition of California and other Western territories at the end of the U.S.-Mexico War, and then the California Gold Rush. So that was really the first kind of research I did, became a kind of springboard for this book in a way that maybe isn't entirely self-evident.
Well, before we touch on that, I do want to just sort of go back and reminisce a little bit. But you know, the first time we met, you know, as I think you'll recall, I reached out to you out of the blue, I think maybe 5 or 6 years ago when I was still in graduate school, because I had discovered that there was somebody who it seemed like had almost exactly the same kind of career path that I had, which was going to Amherst, as you alluded to. And then we worked for the same consulting firm.
We
both went to get a PhD in history mm-hmm. on opposite sides of the coast, as it turned out. But our advisors know each other well and are friendly. You know, so it struck me, and you were so generous back then to offer to meet up, and we had a nice lunch, you know, back in whatever that was, 2015, 2016 in Pomona. Mm-hmm. I still remember you took me to that great taco place. And I so appreciate that you've, you know, kind of continued to stay in touch and to, we were actually, I think we were supposed to see each other in New Orleans next month for the Society of Historians of American Foreign Relations, but
it's true.
Unfortunately, the pandemic is keeping us apart.
Yes, one of many things that the pandemic has wrought. I do remember. I remember you emailing me, and of course, we didn't overlap at Amherst. I think I'm class of 2000. I think you're class of 2006. Are you?
That's right.
Yeah, six. And but it is funny how parallel our careers have been, because it's not. I mean, it is common to go to Amherst and then go work in management consulting, right? I think that's actually a very typical thing for an Amherst grad to do after college. But I don't think there are many of us who then went from consulting to get the PhD in history, right? I mean, not that we're the only two, but I don't think that's a very common career path. So.
No, I think that's right. But one of the things that it does occur to me, you know, and perhaps you might have some thoughts about this before we talk about the book, is, you know, in this era of talking about the alt-ac, you know, careers, and one of the things that, you know, people are really thinking about now is what the job market is going to look like for next year, given some of the, you know, austerity measures that different universities are putting, you know, is how you think about the way that consulting did or did not influence how you approached history, or how you sort of see, you know, your career path as it went from, you know, studying history at Amherst in undergrad to working in the business sector and then coming into, you know, academia and working as a faculty member, you know, mm-hmm. do you see that sort of playing out in a way that has influenced how you approach your work or how you do research? What kind of lessons have you drawn from, you know, working outside of academia into what you do now?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think about this a lot in a number of different ways. So when I was at Amherst, and I don't know what your experience was, but when I was at Amherst, I was encouraged by my senior thesis advisor to pursue a career in history. It wasn't that I had never thought about it, but I think I just didn't know that much about it. And so she, while I was a junior and then a senior writing my thesis with her, she really sort of encouraged me to explore that as a potential career path. But it felt as though all I had done up to that point was school. And I was very good at school, but I didn't really know anything but that. So one thing that I think doing consulting, delaying graduate school for a couple of years and doing management consulting did was it really launched me into a very different kind of environment. And as you know, management consulting is very project-based. So I worked on medium duty truck manufacturing. I worked in pharmaceuticals. I worked in a kind of marketing project for a major retailer, which is now out of business. Actually, a lot of my former clients, as I'm thinking about it, are now out of business. might be a reflection on me as a consultant, but I hope not. But it really was great to get a kind of sampler of how a lot of different people lived and how they worked and what the kinds of jobs were like. I mean, I was in medium-duty truck manufacturing plants in West Virginia for one of my cases. So I think as a historian and as someone who is a social historian by training, just being in that world and having these little windows onto so many different ways of life and ways of working and different cultures of work, it was really broadening in a way that in a kind of a broadening experience that I hadn't had before. So I think one, that was good preparation, but two, it also really matured me and professionalized me in a way that I think graduate school doesn't necessarily encourage. I think graduate school can often be a state of arrested development, right? You know, you basically roll out of undergrad into grad school and you can kind of be the same person who you've been and sleep until 10 a.m. and play a lot of Fortnite or whatever. I'm not a Fortnite player, but, you know, pick whatever your, brainless pastime is. You can kind of continue that in graduate school to a certain extent. So I think actually leaving the school environment, going and working at the firm that you and I worked at, it really forced me to develop some more adult professional habits much earlier than I think I otherwise would have. So when I started graduate school at 24, I already felt as though, you know, I was on a clock. You know, I had a business day. If I had a meeting with my advisor or any of my mentors, I had an agenda. You know, I had a kind of professional outlook that I think I learned doing consulting. So, of course, you know, now when I talk to students and they're thinking about academic careers or, you know, alt-ac careers, you know, I think I do have a perspective to offer them. I did go back to get a PhD. I knew it was the right thing for me. I knew as I looked ahead at the career path in consulting that I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to get an MBA. I didn't want to kind of rise up in the hierarchy in that way. So I feel as though I had a much more certainty and commitment about pursuing an academic career, which is something you need to have if you're going to do it. It takes, 5, 6, 8 years to get a PhD. The job market is, as we know, what it is. And I think if you don't have that real clarity of vision and drive and sense of purpose in this career, it can be really hard to sustain the commitment to it in the years that it can take to develop the kind of career that you want. So yeah, no, I am enormously grateful for my time at our former firm, which is also now no longer in existence. but, you know, I think it really did. It really was a great foundation for me and what I needed at that time.
Yeah, I think those are kind of my experiences too, you know, in thinking about how that experience translates into certain kind of skills. You know, and just thinking about what historians really do, which is essentially put together narratives with incomplete data or conflicting data, right? Which is kind of what consultants also do. I swear this is not a paid advertisement for the management consulting industry, but I do think it's useful to sort of think through some of the different paths that we have traveled on, you know, and where they might have led and how we come to do the work that we do, which leads us back to the question that I think you left us with on the last question that I asked you about, you know, your work and your background. Your first book was really about, you know, who owns land and how much should they own, right? It's sort of in the American West. This is about Chinese medicine. Tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book about the history of Chinese medicine in the United States.
I know they don't seem all that related, but they really are. I get that question a lot because it does seem like a big shift. Yes, my first book was a book called Squatters Republic, Land and the Politics of Monopoly in California. And it was a social history of squatters. It was a social history of people who came to California and they claimed to own the land that they used and occupied. So I learned a lot in writing that book. That book was based on my dissertation. It was very much a book about the American West. It was engaged with questions that are really central to that field. It was about a quirky cast of characters. I mean, these squatters who I wrote about in that book, I really came to love them and see them as kind of people in my life. And I think the thing that I learned most writing that book, first the dissertation and then the book, was I learned about what kind of history I like to do, what kind of historical research I like to do. And what it is I like to research people. I like to research ordinary people and follow them through time and learn about their weird habits and ways of thinking and strange encounters that they have with others. So when I finished that book and I was thinking about, okay, what am I going to do next? What's my second project, big book project going to be? I wanted to do more of that kind of research. I wanted to write about people. And then there are really two other things that took me to Chinese medicine. The first was that I am Chinese American, at least on my mom's side. And pretty much, and I don't know if this is your experience, Ian, but I think when you are Chinese American or when you inhabit a certain kind of identity, I think broadly defined, a social identity broadly defined, and you're in social history, very often people kindly and innocently will ask you, oh, do you write the history of that group, right? So for me, being a Chinese American, are you going to write about Chinese Americans? And I had always really resisted that because I didn't want to be kind of reduced in that way. It felt to me very reductive to say, well, I am Chinese American and I've had these kinds of embodied experiences, so that's what I should write about. But, you know, by the time I finished the second book, I was sort of ready to set that aside. I wanted to write about people who I knew and places I was from and learn more about my heritage, my culture, because my great-grandparents did immigrate to San Francisco from Canton in the late 19th century. So I was sort of just interested in that history. And then the second thing that pushed me toward Chinese medicine is I was living and working in Portland, Oregon. I was my first job out of graduate school was at Reed College in Portland. And anyone who lives in Oregon knows about this really remarkable apothecary, a Chinese apothecary that has been preserved by the state. It's a state heritage site. It's way out in eastern Oregon, very rural part of the state, very depressed, very poor part of the state. So it's in a town called John Day on the John Day River. And it was in the late 19th century a gold town. It was a gold rush town. And a lot of Chinese miners settled there in the 1880s and stayed. And they stayed and worked in the timber industry, predominantly a little bit in ranching, but mostly timber. And one of these people who went there to prospect for gold was a man named Ying He. He had not been trained as an herbalist. He had immigrated from China with his father. He'd immigrated to Walla Walla, Washington, which wasn't very far away. And then he went to John Day when they discovered gold. So he had a kind of ordinary, or maybe I should say typical experience for a Chinese man at that time. But when he got to John Day, he fell under the apprenticeship, kind of accidentally became apprenticed to a Chinese herbalist. And he learned pulsology, which is diagnosis by pulse. He learned herbalism from this other Chinese man who was living there. And then he went into business with two other Chinese immigrants. They purchased a dry goods store and they turned it into an apothecary. And that apothecary in John Day was in operation basically continuously for the better part of about 50 or 60 years until Ying He was too old to live out there on his own, and his nephew kind of moved him out and took him to Portland. So when the nephew came and moved his uncle out, the nephew just locked the door on this building and walked away. And this was in the 1940s. So for about not quite 30 years, that building sat like a tomb, just frozen in time, and no one went in, no one touched it. And then in the 1970s, with the bicentennial celebration of the United States Bicentennial Celebration, there suddenly was a lot more money available for doing local preservationist type projects. So the state of Oregon came into possession of this building. They turned it into a museum. They turned it into an archive. It's a park you can go and visit. It's a state heritage park. And you can go and learn about Inge and his life. So like I said, I was living in Portland, and everyone kind of knows about this place. It's been the subject of an Oregon Public Broadcasting documentary. I had a student at Reed who had worked on that documentary. And so in talking to that student, I started to think, you know, gosh, I wonder if there are other people like Inge. I mean, I wonder how many of these Chinese herbalists there were. And because I was interested in the American West, I was mostly thinking, you know, I wonder where they are in the American West. And so sometime around 2011, I just started looking for them. And it was a real kind of hunt and peck project. But what I started to realize as I just kept finding more and more of these, mostly men, but some women, is that Chinese herbalists were everywhere. Anywhere there were Chinese people, there were Chinese herbalists. And in many ways, they were just hiding in plain sight. It became easy to find them once I started looking. So I didn't necessarily intend for it to become a book. But after a while, it just felt like it had to be, that that there was too much to say about these people for just an article, that they really deserved a story. And so it became this book project.
I love your the way you frame that, right? That wherever there were Chinese immigrants, there were Chinese herbalists. And I think that's why in some ways this is such an important kind of addition to the historiography on Chinese American immigration, because it reflects in some ways, you know, the sort of basic social history of the community, but also as we'll talk about in a bit, you know, the community's interactions with non-Chinese, with white and Spanish-speaking Americans as well. Before we go there, you know, one of the things I wanted to sort of start off with is to kind of just talk quickly about the historiographical interventions that you're making in the book. And part of what I loved about the introduction, in fact, was how ambitious yet lucid the explanation of those major interventions are. And I picked up on five, and you can test my reading abilities by deciding whether or not I've summarized it. But I wonder if you can talk a bit about the kind of interventions you're making in the history of Chinese medicine in the United States, in the history of American Orientalism, in the history of American medicine, in the history of public health, and in environmental history, right? Sort of five major areas that this book about Chinese medicine in the United States addresses. Can you just maybe summarize for us a little bit what those major interventions are and how you see this book adding to the literature?
Sure. You know, so let's start with the history of Chinese medicine, which is such a vast and rich field. You know, I think this is really something where over time, historians and anthropologists looking at the development of Chinese medical knowledge systems and their diaspora, they've really done such extraordinary and diverse work. So now we think of Chinese medicine, I think in this country, in a fairly simplistic way. We tend to think of it as acupuncture and herbalism. But, you know, Chinese medicine is really an umbrella term for just this remarkable array of modalities. So one thing that I became interested in thinking about its transplantation to the United States is really about how, like I said, something that is so remarkably diverse transforms and becomes something other in the United States. It still retains a kind of core connection to the traditions in China. But in some ways, it does become its own thing in this environment. It becomes responsive to other kinds of medical epistemologies, medical cultures, medical consumerism that its practitioners encounter. And so I think if there's an intervention that I make in the history of Chinese medicine, it is really to look at its transmission, its transplantation to the United States in a more, let's say, like longitudinal way than really has been done before. There haven't been other books that have taken this really long view, a two-century view of Chinese medicine in the United States. But I think it does allow me to kind of join that conversation that other historians and anthropologists have been building over the decades about traditional Chinese medicine or traditional Chinese medical therapies. As you said, I mean, I believe kind of first and foremost, this is a social history of medicine, that it's about Chinese immigrants, Chinese entrepreneurs coming to the United States. And I think one thing that I really admire about these people who I write about is that entrepreneurial spirit. So a kind of central intervention I make in the book is looking critically at the kind of terms of their entrepreneurship. So other people who've written about Chinese herbalists in the United States have largely written about them as people who overcame adversity, who confronted, major barriers, major kind of forms of discrimination, right, marginalization. All of that is absolutely true, that Chinese herbalists confronted all of that, that they found ways of overcoming it, that they found ways of convincing non-Chinese patients to advocate for them, to be their allies. All of that is absolutely true and is something that a lot of historians and biographers have written about. At the same time, what I argue is that one of the ways in which these entrepreneurs did confront and overcome such barriers is they capitalized on racist discourse. They capitalized on Orientalist expectations. And so what I found is that very often these men and women who were practicing Chinese medicine, who were treating both Chinese and non-Chinese patients, very often I found that the way they succeeded was in basically embracing and reappropriating Orientalist stereotypes. So stereotypes of barbarism, backwardness, effeminacy, deviance. You know, they did not always attempt to reject or dispel these kinds of racist tropes. Very often they said, yes, and this is what makes me a superior practitioner of medicine. This is really my value proposition, is this kind of access to a more essential, more natural, maybe less civilized, ancient system of medical knowledge. So I think that is maybe the major contribution to the literature on Chinese American history or Asian American history, is this kind of narrative of self-orientalization that I talk about, that Chinese doctors really participated in, perpetuated Orientalist stereotypes. They turned them to their own advantage, and they profited from their marginality. And I think that that is something that's a little bit difficult to grapple with. It's certainly something when I was earlier on in the project and presenting it, and very often presenting it to people who were consumers or practitioners of Chinese medicine themselves, I tended to get a lot of pushback about that, that it felt as though I was being unfairly critical of these men and women and critical of their constrained choices. But I think it's really important in the history to confront the ways that these doctors did maintain and perpetuate racism that was directed toward their own community. So as far as kind of public health and really environmental health, one of the things that initially drew me to the project was thinking about discourses of natural medicine. And this is actually a way in which I think I could also talk about the intervention that I make into social history of American medicine too. In the history of American medicine, there has been, I think, a significant amount of attention paid to what we would now call alternative or irregular medical sects. So I think we could think of things like homeopathy, chiropractic medicine. Those are probably the two most obvious, but naturopathy, I mean, there are a bunch. And historians of medicine have written about them and written about the ways in which these medical traditions, these medical sects played on concepts of nature. So I was interested in that in coming to this project because, of course, now in 21st century America, Chinese medicine, especially acupuncture and herbalism, is very much associated with those kinds of complementary and alternative medical traditions. It's very much kind of enveloped into a discourse of natural medicine. So, part of my curiosity about this project was looking at the historical origins of that kind of nature thinking and bringing into a conversation that was already happening amongst historians of medicine, bringing in the dimension that I've been talking about, that, you know, these practitioners of Chinese medicine, which really had basically been entirely ignored by the literature. I think, you know, and I say this in my introduction, you might find a passing reference here or there to Chinese herbalists, but basically they were invisible in that entire corpus of scholarship. But where that necessarily then took me was thinking about not just nature with the capital N, the sort of ideas about nature, but really the real nature. I mean, what the sort of material environment in which Chinese medicine was produced and distributed and consumed. And I had really wanted to do more with that than I did. I had a lot of prescriptions. So the prescription pads that Chinese doctors wrote up. And so I knew to a certain extent the kinds of things they were using in their compounds. And I had really hoped to do a lot more with that than I did, but I really ran up against a kind of problem of sources and translation that it just became really difficult to say very much beyond, these are the types of herbs that they are using. They're tending to prescribe more botanical than zoological medicinal ingredients. They're tending to source more of their ingredients in China than the United States. But it did kind of connect me to this this set of scholars who've been thinking about really environmental health. Like, what does it mean to be a human body in an environment? And how do conceptions of human health flow from that both material and immaterial relationship? So I think where I hope to be intervening, and this is really, I think of myself not as really changing the direction of that literature, but just sort of more building on it, is thinking about how modern conceptions of the human body and the nature of human health evolve in the late 19th and early 20th century. I think at this point, we no longer, as historians, no longer have this sort of sense of like, well, by the early 20th century, the germ theory of disease prevails, and everyone believes that disease is caused by these little microorganisms, which as long as you can kind of sanitize them, contain them, you'll remain in perfect health. We no longer think that there's a sort of switch that happens around the turn of the 20th century. I think everyone accepts and understands the way that. Earlier notions of the human body as being embedded in environment, as being very much in a kind of two-way dialectical relationship with the natural environment. Everyone understands at this point that persists in different ways, even as, let's say, the medical marketplace is being dominated by Western-style medical scientists who are pushing the germ theory, making it more predominant than it had been before. So I guess where I come in is as being part of that, a telling of that story, which is to say, look, these practitioners of Chinese medicine were offering a way of conceptualizing the body and its relationship to nature in ways that felt familiar, felt comfortable to non-Chinese patients in ways that recalled their own experiences with domestic medicine, that appealed to a certain kind of logic of nature that they held on to. So I have in this book kind of embedded Chinese herbalists in that story. But then that compelled me to go back and actually read the literature on the discourse of natural medicine, such as it was in Chinese medicine. And that's where I think we see a really important disconnect, which is that in traditional Chinese medicine, there is, of course, not a sense of like a dichotomous relationship between the natural and the unnatural, or the material and the immaterial. These things exist on a continuum. It's not that one is good and healthy and the other one is bad and unhealthy. But Chinese doctors, I think, quite brilliantly learn a new way of thinking about nature, a new way of talking about natural medicine once they come to the United States. And they are able to sort of translate their therapeutic practices and principles into that language. And I argue that this is really one of the foundations of their success in the United States, is that ability to do that. It's not exactly translation work, but it's more like imaginative, reimagining, I would say, of their traditions.
That's really helpful context for us to dive into the chapters of the book. And I should preface this by telling listeners how it's organized, in addition to the introduction, which you alluded to earlier, and an epilogue that brings us up really to the present day. There are sort of seven chapters that really ambitiously tackle the history of Chinese medicine from the colonial period, you know, all the way up to the 1970s and beyond. And that first chapter, I think, really does a nice job of, again, playing up that congruence in terms of plant-based medicine in colonial and early Republican U.S., you know, with Chinese medical materials. And you talk about some of the ingredients like tea and opium and ginseng that are circulating in American understandings of medicine during that time, much of it sort of inherited from Europe and their familiarity with Chinese medicine through European travels to that country. But I think that's one of the things that it really was astounding in that first chapter, was that the depth of knowledge even back in the late 18th and early 19th century. I don't know, maybe you want to add a little bit more about sort of that deep background. Perhaps it's maybe surprising to listeners that even, you know, colonists and sort of early Americans were aware of and engaged with Chinese medicine.
Yeah, that is, I think, one of the things that to me is no longer surprising, but can be surprising to someone who hasn't thought about this before. But of course, if we think about the history of early modern Europe and its colonial endeavors, a huge amount of colonial energies were spent prospecting for new sources of medicine. So, of course, when European travelers go to China in the kind of late medieval period and the early modern period, one of the things they want to learn about is medicine. So there is, from kind of the time of Marco Polo on, a sort of conduit of sending materia medica, sending medical knowledge too, from China to Europe. And then the United States is really an annex to all of that. So in the colonial period in America and into the era of the early Republic, medicine that has been, or medicinal ingredients that have been imported from China to London end up in American apothecaries. They end up being peddled by itinerant drug sellers in colonial America and the early Republic and the United States in the early Republic. So, in really for Americans of that period, Chinese herbal medicine was sort of part of their habits of self-dosing. It wasn't really all that exotic or unusual, and it wasn't just tea and ginseng and opium, right? It's rhubarb, cassia, camphor, Even something that's recently been in the New York Times because of it's endangered. It's not really a plant and it's not really an insect. It's like a combo plant insect, Cordyceps sinensis. And it's been in the New York Times lately because it's threatened by global climate change. But even back then, that kind of weird plant fungus hybrid was being peddled by American drug sellers. So I think all of that is to say, long before there were actually Chinese people in the United States, at least in significant numbers, there was Chinese medicine. This is how many Americans came to know things about China. And it was not exotic. It was ordinary.
Yeah, and it adds really nicely to this growing literature we have on sort of Asian American history before the mass arrival of Asians in the United States, right? You know, sort of Jack Chen's work and others who've written about, you know, for example, porcelains and, you know, and their presence in early American history. You know, one of the things I found particularly striking was that you write at one point that some of these sort of advertisements urging people to sort of seek out ginseng in Western lands was one of the sort of maybe motivations for people to kind of, you know, move westward. And so to the extent that, you know, ginseng, Chinese medicine, you know, concerns with China is tied directly to westward expansion during this period, this early period is really striking, again, for reorienting our understanding of how, you know, imagination about China and Chinese culture becomes implicated in nation building and settler colonialism. You know, in North America. With that, maybe we can sort of turn to the next, and I want to sort of frame this as the next four chapters as being about the long progressive era. I'm gonna ask that very annoying oral exam question, you know, type of question about the progressive era, right? Because I think you and I share this an interest in this time period. You've written about the Gilded Age as well. You know, the progressive era and the, specifically in this book, the trans-Pacific nature of the progressive era is something that I think is only starting to be explored. You know, it takes place in this book in the form of migration, but also the kind of policing and regulation of authority and medical knowledge. So how do you think about the progressive era through the lens of Chinese medicine? You know, what does that subject help us understand more about this very crucial period of American history?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we could talk about the progressive era all day long. I share a love of it with you. It's so to me, this is really a story about what does it mean to be modern? I mean, I think that is such the central question of progressivism. And I think this story about Chinese herbal doctors is a window onto kind of the many different competing meanings and valences of modernity in the late 19th and early 20th century. We can kind of attack this from a number of angles, but let's start with just this issue of regulation, the rise of bureaucracies. This is the moment, right? The late 19th and early 20th century is the moment that public health, that medical bureaucracies at the state and local level, that they coalesce. It's not that they were absent before, but they achieve a kind of presence and uniformity of vision that is socially transformative. I mean, it is and environmentally transformative. And I think one of the things that this project explores is the way that those bureaucracies are constructed in the space, in the kind of negotiated space between officials, bureaucrats, elite, kind of knowledge brokers, and these Chinese herbalists, that there is a way in which authority, the authority to regulate and the authority to kind of dictate the terms of the medical marketplace only happens, right? It only kind of comes into being, comes into existence by its distance from and its distinction from the other. And in this case, the other are Chinese herbalists. So this whole book could have been about the kind of legal regime of policing Chinese herbalists, you know, defining what they do as being not only inferior, but being kind of dangerous to human bodies, being sort of or necessitating the interventions of a regulatory state. But I think what's really interesting to me is not just that kind of construction of the modern bureaucracy, but also the cracks in it and the ways in which these Chinese herbalists moving through that system and responding to it are able to both build it up and undo it at the same time. So there is no kind of uniform sense of modernity, progress. There is no kind of uniform sense of what constitutes medical authority. These things are being kind of built up and torn down continuously throughout the progressive era. So yeah, you know, I too use this term, the long progressive era, in this book. I think it's really helpful to see the late 19th century, the last decades of the 19th century, as being a kind of continuous whole with the early part of the 20th century. And so, yeah, I think the book really does sort of trace the evolution of that over about, you know, I would say a 50-year period, at least until the Great Depression kind of drops in and really disrupts possibilities for not only bureaucrats, but practitioners as well. Mostly I focus on the practitioners.
Maybe before we jump into the 1930s, you know, I want to, again, sort of note for listeners that chapters 3, 4, and 5 really focus on, you know, the interactions that Chinese doctors have, herbalists have with non-Chinese consumers and customers and patients. But then, you know, chapters 4 and 5 are looking at the kind of legal, institutional, but also the kind of discursive and rhetorical responses to Chinese medicine in the United States, again, in this moment of increasing regulation. But I wanted to go back to chapter 2 for just a second to give you a chance to talk about the kind of importance of Chinese medicine among Chinese communities in the United States, the social history that you talked about doing earlier. What roles do Chinese medicine and Chinese herbalists play among Chinese immigrants in the long progressive era?
This is something that was really interesting to me as I was starting this project, was learning about the many different roles that Chinese herbalists played within their communities, because obviously they were medical practitioners. Obviously they were diagnosing, prescribing medicine, selling medicine, treating Chinese immigrants. They were there from day one. They were among the first waves of mass immigration from China in the 1850s. So they've always been a part of the community in that sense. But they don't just occupy themselves with healthcare. They really do become more generally supportive of the health of the community. So they are running grocery stores, dry goods stores. They have their shops become kind of centers for religious life and community life. We know that they were often used as places where you might go to worship at a shrine or play cards or dice to get your mail. I think one thing that these Chinese doctors are able to do, because they do tend to be more educated, they do tend to be literate. They serve as basically like a post office very often. They'll write letters home for Chinese immigrants. They'll kind of hold on to mail that comes in from China until Chinese laborers come back from their work site and are able to pick it up. And then I think, not surprisingly, because of their literacy and because of their relative affluence, they often become well positioned to be labor brokers. So making sure that Chinese immigrants can connect with non-Chinese employers. And from labor brokering, it's sort of an easy slide into assisting Chinese immigrants with circumventing exclusion once the first exclusion laws were passed in the 1880s. And then certainly human trafficking. So Yeah, I mean, Chinese doctors become smugglers. You know, they're kind of doing it all. And again, I think it's because of their status, because they are somewhat better educated, because they tend to be somewhat more affluent than other members of their community, and I think they are trusted, right? Their knowledge and their centrality make them kind of imbue them with a natural authority in the community. So a lot of chapter two is thinking about what is it that Chinese herbalists do for Chinese people once they get to the United States. And I do think it's a matter of survival. I think it was hard, to live in the United States as a Chinese person was difficult. It was scary. It was dangerous. The types of jobs that Chinese men and women had in the mid-19th century United States were the most treacherous, were the least desirable kinds of jobs, the most hazardous. And there was very there were very few Western-style practitioners or hospitals that would admit and treat Chinese people. So in a really very basic sense, Chinese herbalists were essential to the health and survival of Chinese immigrants. But then, over time, they do take on these much more expansive roles in providing beyond the basic needs for immigrant communities.
Maybe this might be a good time, too, if you might talk about the sources and the research, the social historical research that you do. You know, in some ways, you know, as figures in the community go, we could imagine Chinese herbalists and doctors to, you know, because they are slightly more educated, a little bit wealthier, than the average Chinese immigrant to the United States during this period, be somewhat more likely to leave behind some records, right? And you alluded earlier to some prescription pads you had, and obviously there's the Camo Chung store that was, as you said, kind of frozen in time. In Oregon. I noticed you also did some oral interviews with descendants of Chinese herbalists and medical practitioners. Tell us about the sources that you used for this particular project and how you put them together.
So the first thing I should say is that really outside of Camo Chung, there aren't a lot of archives, traditional archives, that collect the papers of Chinese herbalists. But there are a few. And so I pretty early on exhausted the kind of traditional archival repositories of these things. And then I did what everyone does. I turned to census manuscripts, court cases, transcripts from court cases. Chinese herbalists got arrested a lot for all sorts of things, mostly practicing without a license, but they get arrested for malpractice. They get arrested for performing abortions when abortion was illegal, when and where it was. So I had arrest records and transcripts from court cases, and certainly no shortage of things written about them. So travel logs and a lot of, let's say, opinion pieces published in newspapers. But then I also had their advertisements published in newspapers, in English language newspapers, in Spanish language newspapers, in Chinese language newspapers. Chinese herbalists were really active users of that medium to promote their work. So I would say most of the sources do come from those types of public records.
And what I love, actually, if I can just add something here that listeners may be interested in, is the way that sometimes those sources interpolate, right? So the way that you talk about how legal records and testimony in court gets used or reproduced in newspaper articles as evidence in support of a particular Chinese doctor's practice, right, is how they sort of, again, you know, as you were saying with earlier with self-orientalizing, reappropriate some of the malicious things that people are saying about them in order to, drive up business or advertise their own services.
Oh, yes. I think one of the practitioners who I write about, who was in Oakland, I mean, he took out I think, a 6-page ad just to print the transcript from one of the times he was arrested and put on trial. So he really, he and not just him, but a lot of them really took the opportunity to use those, that exposure, right, that public exposure, as a marketing tool. I mean, to promote their services and to bring in patients who they had cured and have those patients go on record talking about the efficacy of their medicine. So yeah, no, absolutely. There is a very long tradition of, I guess, turning those lemons into lemonade. And Chinese doctors really were arrested so frequently. I mean, they really got to know the court system well. And I think there's also a connection there to these histories of immigration restrictions and the way that Chinese people had to become quite adept at using the judicial system to advance their cause in circumventing exclusion. There's sort of a continuum here where Chinese herbalists, as their practice was being restricted, were drawing on a lot of those lessons and following in the footsteps of people who'd come before them. Court cases, the court transcripts appear very often in advertisements. But as you mentioned, I ended up doing some oral histories when basically how it works is like, if you are Chinese in America, if you have a Chinese American person, someone who might be related to you or just part of your kind of extended fictive family, someone's an herbalist. Like, I mean, it's like a game of 6 degrees of separation, only it's not as many as six. It's like two degrees of separation. They're just, it was not difficult to find the children of these herbalists. They're elderly, the people that I interviewed, but they are still around. And very often they are holding on to their family papers. So, one woman who I interviewed, she's still alive. She's living in Tucson, and her father and mother had worked. Her father was the herbalist. Her mother was the pharmacist. Her mother compounded the remedies. And they kind of traveled around the American West over the years and opening and closing all of these different little herb shops. So I ended up in this woman's, their daughter's Tucson home, and I was interviewing her really about her recollections, growing up and kind of hanging out at the family store. And she said, I have all of the records. I have all of the business records, prescription pads, all of my dad's, like his scales and the things that he used in the store to measure, the ingredients. I have photographs. I have all this stuff. It's just sitting in my office in Tupperware boxes. Do you want it? And I said, yes. very often these people just have stuff in their garages, or they were just kind of holding on to stuff. Another person I interview who, he was actually a smuggler. He smuggled at a time when there was an embargo on importing Chinese goods above 20 pounds. His dad would send him up to 20 pounds of Chinese medicine in the mail. And he would kind of like piece by piece import Chinese medicine to the United States and then sell it to Chinatown, Los Angeles Chinatown herbalists. And so I went and I interviewed him in his office. And I mean, walking in there, just see, like from floor to ceiling, he has just his life history stacked up. It was great to do some oral histories and just see, everyone has their kind of personal archive, right? They're all sort of, they've become curators of their own history and curators of their family history. And bit by bit, I was able to just add to the story and kind of get more personal connections to the story through these descendants.
That's so remarkable. And I think it'll resonate with, folks who are familiar with, sort of Chinese American, but also, other Asian groups in the United States, the histories and the ways that those are preserved and you know, the ways that entire museums are founded just in some ways through dumpster diving and finding these sort of old records and documents, but also material objects that can finally, you know, be preserved for the rest of the community to be able to appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can spend the last few minutes sort of bringing the story up to the end of the book. Chapters 6 and 7, which are entitled Decline and Rediscovery, respectively, sketch out, I think, you know, even as the title suggests, a trajectory that's very contingent for Chinese medicine in the United States from the Great Depression onward. You talk about what happens during the Great Depression and during World War II, and specifically starting in the 1970s, this kind of revival specifically around acupuncture because of an article that someone named James Reston writes about being treated in Beijing in 1971 in the New York Times that instigates a whole kind of new wave of interest. So what happens to Chinese medicine after the long progressive era in the United States from the 1930s onward?
Well, it doesn't go away. And this is something that I think this book is able to show in ways that other histories have not. During the Great Depression, during World War II, and the years following it, there is it's a struggle. It's largely a struggle for all the reasons that this era is a struggle for people, but for Chinese doctors in particular, this is a real kind of crisis moment because supply lines are cut. And the thing about Chinese herbalism is in most cases, for most of the ingredients, Chinese herbalists had to source their supply in China. And that just has to do with the medical tradition that when you take Chinese herbs, it's very much dependent on highly specific types of ingredients, like ingredients that have to be procured not just in a particular place, but in a particular season under a particular moon. I mean, there's this enormous kind of cosmological thinking that goes around the procurement of medicinal plants and animals and minerals in the Chinese medical tradition. So in the 1930s, with the depression and the wars in Asia, I realized we didn't get much chance to talk about the kind of trans-Pacific aspect of the story, but because of the wars in Asia beginning in the 1930s and extending into what we know as World War II, Chinese doctors couldn't restock their shelves. They were struggling not just because of the collapse in the economy, but because of a very kind of basic problem of supply line. And that was continued after the Communist Revolution in China and into the era of the Korean War, the war on the Korean Peninsula, because the United States had an embargo on Chinese imports. So this is, a couple decades of real difficulty for Chinese doctors. But what I found in my research and what I try to get across in the book is that they go into a state of decline, but they don't go away. Many of them go out of business, but not all of them. They find ways, creative ways, to source their ingredients in other places, to use substitutes, to become trained in other therapies and kind of diversify their business. They encourage their children to go into medical professions that are not Chinese herbalism, but that are kind of licensed medical professions. So I really became kind of fascinated in that section about strategies for survival, how it is that Chinese doctors navigated that very, very difficult period in global history, but in their history in sort of more specific ways as well. And then, of course, there is this moment in the early 1970s that I talk about, this moment when through a kind of a confluence of different things, so sort of cultural currents, global affairs, relations between the U.S. and China, changing medical marketplace in the United States, this sort of perfect storm of factors creates an opportunity for Chinese acupuncture to be really rediscovered by American consumers. It's not a modality that had been very significant in the United States. It wasn't something that Chinese herbalists that, who tended to immigrate to the United States had been trained in. When they came to the U.S., acupuncture was sort of just like a kind of low class thing. It was street surgery. So the types of immigrants who came to the U.S. and became herbalists here were sort of above doing that sort of thing. But when acupuncture did sort of sweep the nation, when there's sort of this frenzy for acupuncture in the early 70s, Chinese herbalists were well positioned to kind of take advantage of that moment. And they kind of latch on to acupuncturists. They kind of get swept into the licensing movement for acupuncture. That is to say, licenses in Oriental medicine and acupuncture usually include herbalism. So suddenly they can emerge from these kind of hidden corners of the medical marketplace. They can actually be licensed. And that opens up all of these new possibilities for working within what we think of as mainstream medical care. But I think where I land on that is that this isn't necessarily a happy ending. The whole book is really building up this idea of Chinese doctors profiting from, depending on notions of alterity, notions of their marginality, right? Their otherness. And that's the basis of their value proposition. To be oriental, to be other in that way, is really what they have to offer. And so there's a way in which this new moment, and it's still really playing out in a lot of ways now, it's a really kind of a mixed blessing for practitioners of Chinese medicine. I think many of them don't want to be enveloped into the mainstream medical system here. I think many of them are resistant to the idea that they need to kind of translate their practices and principles for a Western style system of medical knowledge or biomedicine, as we call it now. They believe that what empowers them and what makes them successful, well, has allowed them to survive, is being on the outside and being not a complement to, but an alternative to Western style medical science.
I think that's a really great note to end on, because it summarizes how, as you write in the epilogue, for more than 200 years, practitioners of Chinese medicine in the United States define their work in a series of contradictions. And you define those as between exotic and familiar, between miraculous and empirical, between ancient and modern. And there's so much more for us to explore, and I wish we had more time to talk about the book. But I hope that at least our conversation gives listeners a view into the kind of really rich and contingent history of Chinese medicine in the United States, and the way that it's implicated, in early American interactions and imaginations of China, of immigration, but also interracial relationships during the long progressive era and the regulation of the American medical marketplace, and the way that it's implicated in global war and the Cold War in the mid to late 20th century. So I hope folks will have a chance to explore this book more for themselves. Before we let you go, though, Tamara, tell us what you're working on now. I know the book just came out, so perhaps that's not a good question to ask. You should be relaxing. But do you have any projects on the horizon?
I am so compelled now by this field, the social history of medicine. So it was not something I was trained in, but it's something that I have really started to read much more expansively since working on this project. So I think I don't have really set plans, but I think that I have a couple of new projects, new ideas for ways that I could go deeper into this space. I'm really interested in questions of modernization. And I've been working on a project about industrial spaces and chronic pain conditions in the 19th century United States. So ways in which kind of these new environments that large-scale industrialization created, the way they put new stresses on the human body, and the way that people begin to conceptualize pain and their bodies in pain in different ways. So there's a phenomenon called railroad spine that I'm really interested in. And very often people think of it as being kind of like the earliest imagination iteration of whiplash. So a lot of the kind of historical literature about railroad spine says, you know, this is how people in the 19th century understood the condition of whiplash. But I think there's a lot more to it, because really what railroad spine was this sort of weird, persistent chronic pain condition that ensued mostly for people who were involved in railway accidents, but also for just habitual users of railroads. So I what I see in the literature there, what I see in the sources that I've looked at, is this real concern that maybe the construction of trains, maybe the kind of benefits of train travel and the ways that it can kind of transcend all these natural limitations, maybe that is in fact incompatible with the essence of being in a human body. And so I'm really compelled by that project right now, and I'm really hopeful that now that the semester's over and the summer is here, I can get back to it. It's nearly impossible to get any research done while teaching.
Well, good luck with the research on railroad spine. It sounds truly painful. So I'm glad. Perhaps, you know, akin to the kind of like feeling of being smushed into an airplane seat these days would be another way for people to imagine how terrible that must have been. But thank you again for taking the time to talk to us today about Herbs and Roots. I hope lots of people will find this book interesting. I imagine they will. And it'll be, you know, really broadly applicable to lots of different fields and scholars who are looking at the history of Asian Americans, the history of medicine, the history of Orientalism, environmental history. So thanks again for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, thank you, Ian. This was a lot of fun.
That was my conversation with Tamara Vannett Shelton about her new book, Herbs and Roots, A History of Chinese Doctors in the American Medical Marketplace, published in 2019 by Yale University Press. My name is Ian Shin, and this is New Books in Asian American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. As always, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.